We live today in a society where people either no longer want or understand a role for the church. The church once was part of the scaffolding, structuring itself around society, and in that sense, while not everyone within that structure would see themselves as Christian, it still meant that we could call it a Christian society because of the level of influence of the church. That is not the world that I live in any longer, though for some, that scaffolding is still there to a degree, but for most, it has already been replaced. Or maybe a better way to describe it might be that the bits of scaffolding that are no longer there have been replaced by scaffolding that might be better described as secular. So while I can be a Christian in that society, the dominant influence around me is no longer Christian. The dominant influence around me is secular. We can either withdraw and feel the loss and feel miserable that it's harder to be a Christian today, which I don't actually necessarily believe to be true. So we can feel the loss of that world, or to begin to see the secular world that we live in as a good place, that we get excited about it, because maybe the good news still counts. And if you're a creative type, that means you get to imagine, what does this look like in the world that now exists? I could begin to change the context around me. Our society is best described as post-Christian, and our context is a place which we might not easily recognise if we are solely looking for the parts that are easily described or that the past church might have described as Christian. Some of the Old Testament exiles will become our teachers for the next few weeks, people like Joseph, like Daniel, and like Esther. They lived in a world that wasn't the most familiar world to them. They were removed from what was familiar and placed in the unfamiliar. What made sense to them within Israel did not necessarily immediately make sense to them in their new land. So how did they remain faithful to Yahweh in a culture and in a nation that did not affirm their faith? The world won't congratulate us for being good Christians. Need to give you a bit of a history lesson. Very sorry about this. A king called Nebuchadnezzar, who reigned, look this up on Wikipedia just there now, who reigned from 634 to 562 BC, just in case you think I was very clever and remember those sorts of things. Nebuchadnezzar created what became the Babylonian superpower of the day. It not only subdued, but virtually wiped out any resistance from places like Egypt and Assyria, both superpowers in their own right. So you can understand why little nations like Judah and Israel soon fell to this incredibly powerful nation. For God's people, everything is lost. The walls of Jerusalem fall, the temple is destroyed, and people are carried back to Babylon as slaves of the king. The nation of Israel has now ceased to be. It no longer exists. They are now scattered across and into a Babylonian culture. Mount Zion, the temple, Jerusalem, Israel, all of it is just a wasteland, just a memory. What we know now with hindsight and with the scriptures written during and after this period, we now know that rather than being a disaster for God's people, for the Jews exiled to Babylon and their experience that grows in them, it is actually something that is meaningful and liberating, such as they would never have discovered if they had remained safe and sound in Jerusalem. There are things that we can discover about God, not in the safety of church, but actually we discover things about ourselves and about God as we engage with the world around us. We would not have a lot of the Old Testament if the Jews had never been taken into captivity. The experience of trying to remain faithful to Yahweh on foreign soil in pagan Babylon actually is the making of the Jewish people. The struggle or the religious challenges posed to the Jews in Babylon is this. How do we remain faithful to Yahweh when there is none of the religious paraphernalia to assist us in doing that? There is no temple. There is no priest. There are no calendars of the religious year, or there are no public observations of the religious festivals, there is no keen supporting or encouraging our worship of Yahweh, or checking that we are continuing in the practices of our religion. It has all gone. What would you do? How would you continue? I want to shift this to being in exile today, where we work maybe 12-hour shifts, different times of the day, and you can't remember the last time you were able to go to church two Sundays in a row. Or where maybe in your hall of residence, no one else publicly at least says that they are a Christian. Or maybe you're a teacher in a school and you have to observe all faiths. A lot of the structure, a lot of the scaffolding that we once called the church or Christianity around our society has gone. We are exiles. How do you and I remain faithful to God as exiles when none of or very little of the support structures we may have grown up with as Christians no longer remains, or it is no longer available? The Babylonians did bring the Jews as slaves to their nation, but they did allow them to build their own homes. They were allowed to engage in normal neighbourly activity, and we would have looked, and they would have looked, like any other kind of citizen milling around the streets in a Babylonian city. After a period of generations, the Jews still lived in Babylon. They would have looked like, they sounded like, and they acted Babylonian culturally. However, internally, they were Jewish. How do Babylonian Jews remain faithful to Yahweh? How do they not just survive in Babylon, but they actually thrive? How do we thrive in a context that is not Christian? We today, as Christians, live in what many are calling a post-Christian West. We find ourselves wanting to be faithful to Jesus in a context where there are very little religious practices or culture or understanding that supports or assists us to do that. Now, most of you will not remember this time where shops closed every Sunday. This culturally supported the practice of Christians to attend church on a Sunday. You may remember, although it's highly unlikely, when on a Good Friday, pubs and betting shops closed. Why? So that we would focus on the biggest and the most important Christian festival in the year. All of these cultural structures or practices were like the scaffolding around our society. They assumed that the going to church was a normal practice. They assumed that we were a Christian culture. When you are a Christian in that setting and to invite someone to church, it actually seems very normal. When you talk about faith, it actually seems very normal. But if you remove those as being the norms, they seem like strange conversations. These presumed cultural practices have actually been eroded or removed largely in the 20th century, where there is nothing that culturally supports or encourages us to follow Christ. If this is true for those who already follow Christ, then it follows that it is even stronger in those we are among who do not know Christ. Society will not reward someone for becoming a follower of Jesus. They will not applaud someone for starting to go to church. That has good implications, therefore, for how we do mission in the UK and Ireland today, but would suggest that simply to do things as we once did them culturally and we apply them now might be ever so slightly mad and crazy to undertake. We, seeking to be faithful to Jesus in a pagan Western culture, are faced with exactly the same dilemma that Jews faced in Babylonian culture. How do I, as a follower of Jesus, remain faithful? Not only remain faithful, because sometimes we see remaining faithful as like back against the wall and struggling, but I'm going to keep on believing, I'm going to keep on following. The Jews in Babylon, they became rich, they thrived. So I want to ask that question just ever so slightly differently. How do I, as a follower of Jesus, remain both faithful but thrive in a context where my culture and where the immediate relationships around me at uni or at work or in my street are not going to support or congratulate me for that kind of faith? They may look at it slightly oddly, they may find it intriguing, but actually they will not applaud or make the world shape itself around Christianity. just for us. That is the challenge for us today. One thing we should not do today is to withdraw from our culture. We should not complain that our culture has gone to the dogs. We should not decide to let all get together, gathering the last few remaining Christians we can find and pull them into a little room and try and stay faithful, but hidden away from the world. I think there is a better way. An essential skill of an exile, whether it be those Old Testament exiles or us, is to be able to hold fast to their most dangerous memories or stories. The most hope-filled stories for the Jews exiled, the stories that they returned to again and again to give them hope that there was going to be a better day, were not the stories of Jerusalem. The most hope-filled stories that came from another period of their history, the period we call the Exodus, you can understand how being in exile in Babylon filled you with this deep need to know that God was still faithful, that he would set us free, that there was a better day coming. So the Exodus, this incredible story of being set free from Egypt, it was a dangerous memory that the Jews carried. The biblical metaphor that describes this is the word exile. How do I move out into the culture of which I and you are a part? Those places that don't easily have access to church. Those places like our university campuses, the staff room at work, in our neighbour's kitchen. A good biblical metaphor for us as a Christian in that sort of context that makes sense of our experience, where even to talk about Jesus or to invite someone to a church service, it just seems odd or doesn't easily enter into conversations with those around us. How do we thrive in the places and among the people that we are with, but at the same time not abandon ourselves to its every whim or to its every interest or to its every value? I imagine if you're listening to this and you're genuinely full on into the world that you live in, you will have at times of dilemmas of thinking, I feel like I'm betraying Jesus right now. I feel like I'm a bad Christian. How do I fully engage with the culture around me and be part of it and bless it and thrive? And yet, at times, know that I need to stand against it. At times, being faithful to Jesus and to the values of Jesus will bring me into conflict with people, with culture, and with the world around me. I want to actually change tack, probably from discussing exiles. I want to talk about a story. And the story is the book Watership Down by a guy called Richard Adams. I don't know if you've ever read it or you've watched the movie. I stupidly watched Watership Down as a child, and I have to admit I was traumatised by it. One of the tracks on the movie is Bright Eyes, sung by Simon and Garfunkel. It is a depressing song. But other than that, if you haven't watched it, if you haven't read the book, I'm sure you'll love it. So yeah, just ignore me and go and watch it. A guy called Stanley Howes wrote a book which is entitled A Community of Character. The book is really about Christian ethics and Christian community. Quite an old book now, but his opening chapter, he talks about Watership Down, and he has a few interesting things to say about it. And one of the things that he says is that the thing that shapes us is the story that we bring with us. So whatever story it is that we hold on to most tightly is actually the one that is going to shape us. He doesn't say that, I'm saying that right now. It will define us, and it'll shape our experiences, it'll shape how we see things, and it'll shape the things we talk about. The closer it is to the gospel story, the more freedom and the more liberty. Anyway, what does this guy, Stanley Howes, say about Watership Down? One of the rabbits is absolutely convinced that something bad is going to happen and that everybody, well, all the other rabbits, have to get up and go as soon as possible. And he runs around all of the rabbits and he's trying to recruit as many of them as he can to follow him. However, only a few gather around him and they leave the burrow and they begin to cross the open fields. And as they do, they look back and they see the bulldozers beginning to move in and to dig up and to destroy the common that has been their home for so long. And these rabbits have now become, you've guessed it, exiles.
And in fact, for them, just like the Jews, there is no turning back. There is no Jerusalem to go back to. And there is no Warren left. In terms of their family, there is no Warren left to call home. The story of these exiled rabbits seeking to find their way to Watership Down. And what happens to these rabbits is the beginning and the making of the story of Watership Down. As they cut out across open grassland, they early on encounter that there are other rabbit communities, and they are so relieved to see them. And as they begin to tell these other rabbit communities their best story, these other rabbit communities have a real mixed reaction to them. And these poor rabbits that have had their world destroyed begin to realise this isn't home. This is not actually where we're supposed to settle. If we settle here, we'll have settled too early. And so something in them says, let's keep going. There's something ahead of us that we haven't yet reached. And so because they say no to the version of things that they are presented with by these rabbit communities, they get sometimes very nasty reactions. And so they're even forced at times to continue their search. Howes says that as you watch the rabbits, that we should be asking ourselves, what is it in us, what is it in these rabbits that counteracts against every rabbit-like instinct, which is to burrow, hide, and be safe, and to make other rabbits. So in effect, get on with life, in the way that everybody else just gets on with life. What is it in us that stops us from doing that? These rabbits are on their way to a place called Watership Down. There is no turning back. Howes then asks, what is it that keeps them going when everything in their very bones tells them to stop, start digging down, get into safety, be safe? Any bit of earth would do for that. But yet these rabbits keep running through open fields. They keep running through forests infested with foxes, and they keep crossing rivers. The very things that rabbits do not do, these rabbits find themselves doing. In the book, Howes says that what Adams does in Watership Down, he has these rabbits routinely stop and rehearse the great mythic stories of the first ever rabbit who lived on the earth. And this great rabbit is almost like their god. And they rehearse the stories of El Harar and of his great adventures. Whenever these rabbits are faced with a new challenge and they don't know what to do, they sit down and they start to tell stories. And they start to tell the stories of this great rabbit. And then they get up. And something has happened in them that means that they can now cross this river. Means they can now run across this open field. And they keep stopping and they keep retelling this story above all the other stories that they had learned as baby rabbits from their parents. And these stories of this great mythical rabbit do two things for them. Number one, the story fills them with the courage to keep going. And that should not be underrated. Number two, it often gives them a strategy, or at least it gives them the next step that they might take, which helps them encounter the challenge that is now before them, that they find within the very story the tools that they need to move on. We are not defined as a community and by our buildings, by our worship, by our statements of faith. For us, the thing that makes us who we are the stories of Jesus. Jesus is the making of us. We are joined together as exiles by the remarkable story of our Jesus, the exile. He makes us who we are. He is the one who gets us into trouble, and he's the one who gets us out of it again. Whenever you're living in Jerusalem, you can say, we are Jews because of this temple. We are Jews because of these festivals. We are Jews, and as Jews, this is how we behave. But in Babylon, you, as a Jew, cannot say any of those things. As a Jew, you end up saying, what makes us a Jew is this story above all stories. And the one story that they told themselves over and over again in Babylon, and it gets repeated throughout the Old Testament as a story that they have to keep going back to, and it's the story of the first exile. It's the story that they as a people were led by an exodus out of Egypt. So why would you tell a story like that when you're in Babylon? Whenever you're trapped by a superpower, not allowed to leave, when you've been conquered and controlled, and when you have no freedom to do what it is you believe you want to and should do, then the story of a God who conquers that conqueror, who is a greater control than those who control you, and whose one objective is to set you free. If you keep telling that story, repeating it and retelling it, that story does something to you. The story says that our God does a remarkable thing to pull us out from under the control of a land that has subjected us as slaves. When you tell the story of a Passover from Egypt and you translate it into Babylon, that story becomes a dangerous story to that nation. I know that this was a dangerous story because it got Daniel and his friends into trouble. They were thrown into a fire because even though they tried at times as best they could to fit into this land of Babylon, there was always something that stood out that marked them as different, and they kept getting into trouble for it. We know the story of Daniel being thrown into the lion's den because they were so committed to the story of God. While much of our story of Jesus is actually accepted in our post-Christian world as being very loving, as being a really good example, there is at least one story among all of our stories that is difficult for us to integrate into our world. It is a story that we cannot get around easily, and it's the story that comes to mind when we drink wine and we eat bread. What you are basically saying to Babylon is that what God did to Egypt, he will one day do to you. When you ask us to describe Jesus, we describe the one who lives among us. We describe the one who sets people free. We don't describe one firstly. We will get there, but I don't think it's our first port of call to describe heaven. And the same should be true of us. And so the story of Jesus, in that way, is what is the story that actually needs to give us our shape. We need to see our God as self-exiled, as living among us, and that even before he opens his mouth, that we know that this God who is among us is already on our side. Jesus belongs in a world other than ours. He is, however, exiled into a world that isn't his. It isn't even that he was forced out of heaven, but he made the choice to forgo the privilege of one place for the sake of the other. And this already has huge implications for us. A Jesus who forgoes the privilege of one place for the sake of the other, am I that sort of follower of Jesus? The exiled Jesus shows us what it is like to live well. He makes it his home. He makes it his nation. He makes it his land, and he makes it his people. And he thrives right in the middle of it. It is a far cry from the golden hair of Jesus with the steely blue eyes and the halo around his head. He also isn't a Jesus who grits his teeth like a brave little soldier and gets on with it. We do not have a Jesus who takes a deep breath and presses on from one Sabbath to the next, hoping that it'll all be over very soon. The example of Jesus is someone who actually likes it here. He actually loves life. This Jesus ends up laughing and playing with children, so much so that they end up spending a lot of time around him and they worm their way into his stories. This is a Jesus who faced with a pagan centurion. Rather than looking for a way out, he stops and he looks into this man. And instead of seeing a pagan, instead of seeing all the things that need to be corrected in him, he sees real faith and he calls it for what it is. So what sort of exiled God is this? Because whatever sort of exiled God this is the sort of person that I have no choice but to be like. This Jesus one day walks along through a field and out of the corner of his eye sees some lilies. And he stops his disciples and says, look guys, see the hand of God right there in the middle of it? I am sure there are times they thought, Jesus has lost the plot. And yet this Jesus loved this earth and he loved the people of this earth and he loved being with us. You won't find a Jesus just surviving here on earth, gritting his teeth and hoping for the best. You will find him thriving here on this earth. So by implication, if we are in Christ and he in us, then there are parameters that he has already set in place that are immovable. Therefore, we cannot live beyond them, but nor should we live less than them. And you may already be in uni, you may be in work, you may be living in a street where the Christian presence is very, very small. Please do not choose alternatives. One alternative is to run and to hide in church meetings. Another alternative is just to try and sort of go under the radar and blend in and not to stand out too much. That is as dangerous for the world as it is for us. The story that we're living right now may not have been quite the romantic one that we had thought of whenever we started out following Jesus, but it's the world that we are in, and we are called to love and to thrive in this world. So what are the skills that I need to actually survive here? And more than survive, I need to live loud, large, confident life in a world that won't necessarily congratulate me, because I am making Jesus sound loud. I am making Jesus look large. They will not congratulate me on all counts of that. The ones, the count that he loves us, they will love that. But there are other things that by following Jesus that will get me into a tight corner on occasions. But that story of Jesus, I cannot depart from it. I have a tricky path to follow. It gets me into trouble with those who want me to be more religious. Gets me into the trouble with the world whenever they want me to be less like him. It makes sense that if I am to do evangelism, if I am to exist as a Christian in this world, then the concept of an exile fits. The exiles in the Old Testament clung with everything to one story, and was the story of the Exodus. The story that we have is the death and the resurrection of Jesus. It has huge implications on how we behave as a Christian, how we engage in mission, so go out towards the world, and how we even put words together that begin to describe Jesus to the world around us, because they are not words, they are not cultures that the world around us are necessarily warm to or understand. So how do we do that? So lots, hopefully, lots to discuss in your groups this week.